On the programme, the art and life of painter Harry Kernoff and the inspirational work of NIVAL, the Irish Visual Arts Library. Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight.
The history of art, which goes back as far as scientific knowledge knows to about, let us say, 30,000 years, which is a very brief period in human life. And anything that has lasted has quality, great quality, nothing abstract in my opinion. And you'll find that all these new suns and fashions, a lot of it is fashion, just fades away and just disappears. One doesn't have to do anything about it. It just fades away and disappears.
The voice of Dublin painter Harry Kernoff there. Kernoff captured our capital city as no other visual artist did. Street and pub scenes, people, buildings, the famous and not so famous, oil paintings, watercolour sketches, woodcuts, book illustrations. Kernoff left a huge legacy of observed life and vivid original art. Working through the decades from Irish independence in the 20s through to his death in late 1974, Kernoff had a brilliant eye and a great gift which he worked hard to honour. As well as Dublin life, he painted scenes and people around Ireland and abroad, travelling to Russia in 1930 and always looking out to the wider world while observing the detail of the Irish world in which he lived. Harry Kernoff, The Little Genius, is the title of a new biography of Kernoff by Kevin O'Connor, and this handsome production from the Liffey Press contains many striking colour and black and white reproductions of Kernoff's work. Some material pertaining to Kernoff is contained in the National Irish Visual Arts Library at NCAD in Dublin. We'll hear more about NIVAL later in the programme. Before that though, Kevin O'Connor, I suppose many people will be familiar with Harry Kernoff's distinctive style, his work immediately recognisable, the vivid colour, the kind of heightened realism, and this humanity always there in it. What drew you to Kernoff's art and to writing this book?
It was an accident. In another life, I saw his portrait of James Joyce in a basement sale in Adams, purchased it. I was really, at that time, only coming to read Joyce as an adult. And then I moved on, other things. And then, in another life, again, Garrett O'Connor, an art dealer, asked me would I consider doing a biography of Kernoff, and unwittingly I said yes, just with that tremor of what have I let myself in for. And I let myself in for a lot more work than I thought, because when I began to look at the life, there were layers and layers. As you know, he was born in London. He came to Dublin at the age of 14 in 1914. He lived and painted through the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. And yet there was very little in the public record. So I had to do a lot of research. I went to meet quite a few people, most of whom were forthcoming about him. But even at the end of all that, years off and on, he still seemed an enigmatic figure.
And clearly, in a sense, was. And I suppose he managed to steer this course almost as an insider-outsider in the newly independent Irish state. And it's fascinating to see how well he held that balance.
Yes, he negotiated it quite well, one could say, with the inherited wariness of his race, who had been persecuted across Europe since the 1400s in Spain, had been essentially the victims of periodic genocide.
And, of course, his own family roots, his Jewish family, went right back to Spain.
Yes,
on his mother's side.
When they settled in Dublin, his mother, who was Katya Kernoff, she was the daughter of a rabbi, those two significant things, she became Kate Kernoff in Dublin, a formidable woman who made good meals, very stylish woman. And then in time, let it be known that she was a descendant of the first, in effect, Jewish chancellor of the reign of Ferdinand and Isabella. And in time, his descendants settled in Vitebsk in northern Russia. And then in time, they were the victim of a pogrom, and they left for England, and they settled in Shoreditch in the east end of London. And there is a general acceptance among the extended Kernoff family, who are in South Africa now, that in fact they intended going to South Africa, but they ran out of money in Dublin. Dublin was to be a staging post.
And it was our good fortune that they did, and that Harry Kernoff came to settle in Dublin, in that area around the South Circular, which later became known as Little Jerusalem. It was a significant Jewish community in that area and one that he documented. But Kernoff's artistic talent, obvious from early on, and he was eventually to go to night classes in the famous Metropolitan School of Art in Kildare Street. Some very important influences from tutors, from teachers there, people like Sean Keating.
Keating, of course, a seminal influence in modern Irish art. And then Keating kind of adopted, became a patron for Kernoff, whom he called the little genius. And when independence came, after the revolution of 1916, 1919, independence with the Free State, Keating faced his own disillusion. Because one of the first things the Free State did, the new Department of Education, was it dumped the art school. Up until then, interestingly enough, under the imperial system, the Metropolitan Art School in Dublin was one of the great art schools of Europe, produced students who won the prizes at South Kensington and so on. But then with independence had to detach. And Keating, who thought he was carrying the flag for artistic and national independence, found he was abandoned.
And of course, these are the ironies that come with politics and nationalism. Kernoff at the heart of some of that. I mean, again, this pull between the people like Keating, who wanted to make an art that celebrated a kind of independence and this mythical past, and modernists, I suppose, people like maybe Jellet and Evie Hone, who were looking at the possibilities of, you know, from Impressionism and Cubism and new international art. Where did Kernoff fit into that pull and debate? How did he place himself?
Well, I suspect purely on instinct. With Keating as the head of that section of the school, portraiture and life art and so on, was McGonagall, Maurice McGonagall, who was a contemporary of Kernoff's, both of them studying under Keating, and then in time, McGonagall became a teacher. Now, McGonagall, one has to say, fought an active role in the War of Independence. And a bit like Keating, left him stare into this empty space. And Kernoff, after all, had no memory of Irish victimisation. He wasn't a product of the famine. But here he was in an Ireland that achieved independence through military means and political negotiation. And he had some fellow feeling for independence, for anti-imperialism. But the streak or seam of syndicalism, anti-imperialism, socialism, is strong in migrant Jewish families. You can see it everywhere. And Kernoff had that in his bones. So therefore, it was, I think, inevitable that he would side with the Republican stroke independent Irish element in the art school. Now, to try and answer your question, how does one decipher that by looking at his paintings? He did paintings of volunteers. He did paintings of officers in the new Free State Army. But I think the answer lies much later. You look at some of his paintings of the 40s and 50s, the hard-faced guys in the bar, the guys with the sheepskin collar up. They're not readily identifiable, and I went to some trouble to find out who they were. Are you surprised to know who they are? They're the hard gunmen who were left high and dry after the revolution. They're the tail end of Republican assassination gangs. Some of them had extraordinary histories. One was a communist and a Republican in London. He was crucial to springing De Valera from Lincoln Jail. Another was X, another was Y. And Kernoff painted them quite sympathetically without losing that bitterness in them.
So he was painting a part of what was almost becoming a hidden history, in a sense. And again, as well, again, so much we should be grateful to Kernoff for in capturing a Dublin and Ireland over those decades. But in 1930, he goes to Russia as part of a delegation friendly to the new Soviet Union. How did that trip come about, and did it have any influence then on his later work?
There was a nice Soviet delegation to help recognise the new Soviet state. The background to it was that the newly independent Irish Free State was one of the first to fund Russia by taking the Russian crown jewels as security and giving them money. Britain or America wasn't going to do that, and most of the European powers weren't going to do it. And then you had, after the revolution, you had this disenfranchised coterie of intellectuals and militants. Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, whose husband, a pacifist, had been shot by a mad British Army officer during the revolution. You had Harry Karnoff. You had two or three other people who were sympathetic fellow travellers who boarded in London. But the upshot was they thought they were going to see the ideal state created out of communism. If you look at Hannah Sheehan Skeffington's memoirs, which are in the library, and she had to write them on flimsy, what appears to me to be toilet paper in pencil, because they were discouraged from making the record. And she puts the best glance on it. She tries to say things like, oh, well, you know, servitude is gone. She doesn't say who now will do the housework. Waiters, you don't tip waiters because it's offensive. And she, in my view, warbles on a bit, well-meaning. Karnoff, with his Russian background, speaking Yiddish, understanding Russian, understanding Yiddish, was not fooled. So on the one hand, you had Sheehy Skeffington, who's has the main record of what they witnessed over 3 months, inclined to accept the utopian vision post the Russian Revolution of what they'd achieved. But from what I can glean from what Harry wrote in a couple of magazines afterwards and from talking to people who knew him around that time, he was bitterly disillusioned. He sensed what became the Stalin terror. He was a guest of the Union of Soviet Artists and so on, and they obviously were telling him quietly, you know, you had to do, as an artist, you really had to do now state propaganda.
And there's a remarkable work reproduced in the in your book, and seldom seen before, this woodcut of his and a train in Ukraine in 1931, and it seems to anticipate the later Holocaust, but actually what it's marking is Stalin's Holocaust.
That's true. That painting, which was kept in the family, rarely seen in public, and for all kinds of reasons was a bit disturbing to the family, was released to me for the book by the family, by his niece in London. And when I asked her, because I assumed too it was a painting of the Holocaust from World War II, from Germany, and no, on the back is 1931. So this is Stalin's Holocaust. And as you know, it's a horrific painting and presaged the skeletal transportation of people by the state.
Kevin, Karnoff's mother, you know, as I said, really a dominant figure and very, very important to him. And I suppose, you know, she seems to have influenced his life in a very deep way.
Well, she was the first uncritical gallery audience for his work when he started as a child doodling and drawing. Of all of her children, as she said, when somebody complained, one of the children, adult children, she said, what Harry wants, Harry must get. But the downside of that was the Jewish community supported Harry in that they commissioned portraits, but they wouldn't have approved of him marrying because he was an impecunious artist. And the newly rising Catholic middle class, while they'd commission a work, wouldn't approve of a daughter, Catholic daughter. So poor Harry was left in no man's land, which effectively meant that he had relations with married women.
He himself never married?
No, he never married. Whether he had offspring is a moot point, but his romantic life was bordered by two great loves of his life. One was Tota Cogley, who started the Dublin Cabaret after the revolution, and the other was Delia Murphy, the singer, salon singer, ballad singer.
A remarkable woman, and there are fine portraits of both those women in your book, and obviously, you know, Karnoff had a deep love for both. You know, looking at the work and the reproductions in your book, Kevin, what is struck by the great sense of an artist both capturing and celebrating life, and in all the work, this great sense of human sympathy that we've talked about. But you know, the fine portraits, I think, when you've talked about your own, the one you have yourself of Joyce, Delia Murphy, St. John Gogarty, some lovely self-portraits. But then there was a portrait of Sean O'Casey, which O'Casey wasn't happy with at all.
No, and it shows O'Casey as narrow, spleenful, resentful, wary, which shouldn't come as a surprise from the 1920s, because that was O'Casey's public stance. His public stance against the new Irish state, which had censored him, and his public stance against the imperial powers in Europe. Anyway, a row erupted between them when the painting was shown in London. O'Casey gave an interview to the Daily Herald, the left-wing daily paper at the time, and he disavowed the portrait. He didn't like it. He thought it was a misrepresentation, and he said that he had never sat for Carnoff. Now, Carnoff said he'd been three times a visitor to O'Casey's London home. I don't know.
But it's one way or another, I think it's a terrific painting. I also love the portrait of the Lavender Man, this famous Dublin street character who was believed to sell fake lavender and real condoms. It is a marvellous painting.
That's a lovely painting. People are very, very affectionate for reasons I don't fully understand about that painting. I think it's the peddler in the street, you know, managing to sell things the state, the new Catholic state, doesn't want sold.
But again, it's that wonderful quiet subversion.
It is.
Of what's behind the painting, the truth behind what we see.
I've no doubt that Harry, in his own way, without being part, without being a paid-up member of any political movement, his instincts were down on the ground. His instincts were to sympathise with people. His instincts were to sympathise with people who went about their daily chores, costermongers. He's quite a few women pushing carts of offal or rags. I'm not sure what's under the cover. His butcher's dozen of an inner city Dublin slum during the debate on contraception here, which is rarely seen in public. Now, that is a powerfully political painting of that time.
And of course, Carnoff was never less than his own man, even in terms of his views on other great artists. And here he is on Picasso.
I'd say that he, at least you can say this much about him, that he could draw if he wanted to. And his early work is very, very good. But his later stuff, I think, is very ephemeral. Won't last.
You see, a lot of artistic aficionados, if I can put it that way, will now be screaming somewhere, tearing their hair out in dirty great chunks and saying, Carnoff is preaching heresy. Of course there was great art in Picasso. And an awful lot of the ordinary punters will be saying, that man is saying what I always believed.
Yeah, I know.
So where do we find, where is the truth between the two of them?
The answer to that is, what is truth?
Aha. That's
a question. Now we're getting somewhere, you see. And that's almost, I would say, an insoluble problem, except one's own opinion, really. And if you have a fixation about a thing, you think that is truth. But what is it? Nobody knows. Nobody knows. Except as regards work of art or painting, the only truth is, relative to oneself, is integrity, I think, to one's aesthetic integrity.
Harry Carnoff there in a 1973 interview with Liam Nolan from the RTE Radio Archives. Kevin O'Connor, the White Stag movement and the Living Art movement of the war years, White Stag group, people in rebellion, I suppose, against the dominance of the RHA in particular. And you might have expected a figure like Carnoff to fall in with such a movement, but he didn't.
No, it's a bit surprising. I don't know the full answer to that. I think he was innately suspicious of all movements. And although this one was well-intentioned, it consisted of expats fleeing war in Europe. They believed themselves to be conscientious objectors. They were also artists. But they couldn't be totally removed from the seismic upheavals that the war was causing. And their, I think, innate response was to come away from Renaissance art and come up with a kind of a fractured view of reality, which, innately or not, coincided with what was happening in the countries they'd fled from. The whole of Europe was fracturing. They gave lectures. What is the nature of reality? Contemplate before you apply the brush. If you take a certain kind of substance, it helps give you an elevated perception of reality. And then, of course, because they were British and German, they became the object of special brand surveillance, so you could have an image of the guard at the back in the overcoat listening to the lecture on what is reality and so on and trying surreptitiously to make notes. But, you know, that's being a bit frivolous about them. They were definitely a movement. They were definitely well-intentioned. Why did Harry not join them? He didn't like joining any movement. He was a bit suspicious of them.
Another interesting aspect of all this is his relationship with the National Gallery of the time. The gallery now owns several Carnoffs, and they're very proud to have them. But at the time, they were perhaps a little wary of Carnoff and his work.
By the late 60s, Harry, who by his own admission felt he was slowing up and had very little money, and some of his immediate circle, some of the loves of his life, were not well or were not long for this world, Harry was a bit bereft. And more and more he appeared, according to people who remember him from that time, he appeared like a peddler with his woodcuts in the pub, offering a woodcut for 2 and 6p, offering to put somebody's name on a card and he'd do a woodcut type drawing for a shilling and so on. And around that time, he offered his entire collection, wonderful collection now in retrospect, James Joyce, Brendan Behan, O'Casey, Oliver Gogarty. He had around 30 portraits of what we now regard as seminal figures in the evolution of Irish culture. He offered them to the National Gallery and they said no. And he wrote back saying, there are no pockets in a shroud. Would you be prepared to buy them for less money for each? And they said no. And he wrote back and said, well, I don't want to break up the collection. You can have them for £25 each. And James White, the director of the National Gallery, said no, saying that the board had decided not to. Well, you know, it's a moot question, whether it was the board or whether James White, director of the gallery, influenced the board. I mean, who knows? There is a view that White regarded Harry Carnoff as a bit of a bowsy. He was around town drinking with the likes of Paddy Kavanagh, Brendan Behan, poets, people who could be seen to be drunk or shouting across the street. It wasn't the kind of person the National Gallery wanted to buy paintings from.
At that time. He's been compared, Carnoff's been compared to Lowry, the great Manchester painter, and it seems like a very, very valid comparison. In a sense, what he did for Dublin, what he captured of Dublin, is similar in a way to Lowry's spirit of Manchester.
The view has been put to me that he's better than Lowry. That Lowry is caricatured, the matchstick men, fine. But that Carnoff fills them out better. I mean, he's rumpy women. He's humble people going about, you know, the kind of tedious task of getting a horse out of a stable, out of Baggot Street to pull a milk cart. Somebody going to get offal from the abattoir to sell it in a kind of in a butcher's or somewhere like that. I'm not in a position to judge that. To what extent he was influenced by Lowry, I don't know.
One of the great Irish artists of the 20th century?
Oh, I would think so. Oh, yes, I wouldn't have embarked on it if I didn't innately believe that. And I'm waiting to have that view confirmed.
And I suppose, in a sense, you know, he left thousands of works, but really the true worth, the true value and his achievement only now becoming, I think, fully appreciated.
I think so. Look, one of the country's top collectors in a recent memoir said that he didn't think much of Harry Carnoff, but then when Harry's price zoomed, he went back to revisit him and thought, well, yes, maybe he has something, even though, as he put it, he doesn't appeal to my deepest instincts.
But he might appeal to the deeper pockets. Kevin O'Connor, thanks very much. Kevin O'Connor's book, Harry Carnoff, The Little Genius, is published by the Liffey Press.
Vincent Woods there with Arts Tonight, which is produced by Sarah Binchy. Well, because of the extended coverage of events in Boston, that visit to the National Irish Visual Art Library at NCAD with Edward Murphy, mentioned by Vincent, will be held over for broadcast on Arts Tonight in the coming weeks.